I try not to act like it. I know at least 3 decent jokes. I'm pretty smart. I will go see student performances, even if it's choir or a musical. I do no harm. I do some harm, but I feel bad about it, and then try to fix it. I try to keep things relevant, even when they aren't. I see school through students' eyes sometimes. I reflect. I'm honest. I'm respectful. I'm trustful. I'm realistic. So, are you a terrible teacher? Tally up your score and find out. Category 1. If you have checked any items in this category, you suck. Go to something else. Okay, fine. If you only check the 4th but not the other 3, be an administrator. Whatever. Category 2. Did you check the first 2? Great. You're set. 3's not bad either. The rest of the things will probably help, but are wildly biased toward my own brand of teaching. Teaching is just really hard. You are working as hard as you think you are. You are holding yourself to an impossible and essential standard of success, and you should keep doing that. But you should know that you're successful on levels you don't always see or know. Sometimes you'll feel like you suck, and sometimes you legitimately will. Do you care? You'll be fine. Do you care a lot? You'll probably be great. Part 3. Winter. In winter, I set my alarm earlier because it's going to be dark when I wake up no matter what. I get to school before almost everyone, make a pot of coffee, sit and look out the window, and feel warm and settled. Winter is a time to take care of yourself, even when it's hard, to take care of your kids because they make it hard, and to do the best, biggest, most fun things. Because just making it out of bed is a pretty big deal. The goddamn internet. I graduated from high school in 1999 with a GPA high enough for a 4-year college, though not so high to get into a college that would impress anyone. To graduate high school successfully, I did many things that I found to be pointless, and I was pretty good at them. The smart kids remembered everything and were rarely asked to think about anything. 17 years later, my education is relevant for little other than trivia night. I don't blame my high school, though I greatly disliked it, because who then could have imagined the immediate and constant access to information we would soon have? Access that put at our fingertips nearly everything the smart kids were rewarded for remembering. Still, that information is here, and until the zombie apocalypse kills us all, or at least our cell towers, the information isn't going away. Schools are jumping all over the technology wave, only a decade or so after the wave crashed over everyone else, but still. Schools roll out new devices, digital tools, online communication, and increased access for students every year. Too often, though, new tools are being asked to fix old problems. Worse still, we sometimes exclude technology from the classroom, forcing a tech-free zone that exists no other place in kids' lives. It's handy for us because we can keep teaching the way we were taught, but I don't imagine it's particularly helpful for those students when they leave our rooms. Late in my first year of teaching, I was reading the book Coffer Boy, an apartheid-era memoir, with my students. The book is long, detailed, and full of interesting and shocking stories. To help kids keep up with everything happening in the novel, and to separate the pages on the Soweto riots from the pages on the layout of the family's third home, I had them keep chapter summaries in notebooks. Some students used multicolored post-its. Red for plot summary, yellow for individual people of importance, green for important or interesting quotes. It all felt very much like I must be teaching something pretty important and students must be learning. It was, after all, the exact sort of thing I had done, or pretended to get done, while I was in school. Of course, I had little intention of ever reading through the volumes of summaries being hammered out by my students. I assigned the summaries as one of a few layers of threat to get them to read the book. There would also be quizzes, graded discussions, projects, and an essay final, all asking, in one way or another, "Did you read it?" Of course, it didn't occur to me the insult it is to children to assume they won't read a good book when given one, or that they should read a not good book because we said so, or that writing short summaries and recalling inane details have anything to do with the way books as an art are to be explored and enjoyed. 2 years later, I was doing the same book in the same dumb way, mainly, I think, because I did it 4th quarter and meant to work on it during the school year, and then I'd think, Nah, I'll work on it over the summer for next year, then spent my summer biking, playing video games, and napping. By that third year, though, the students stopped complaining about the summaries. The summaries themselves, those I read anyway, were longer and more detailed. I chalked up the improved quality of work to the two things I credited all year for the good things happening in my room. The kids all had laptops, provided by the school, that made work more efficient and more engaging to do. And I was in my third year and getting really damn good at my job. While grading them, I came across a few sentences. Something about them, especially coming from an eighth grader, seemed almost poetic and certainly brilliant. Does he want to die? The threats are real. A collection of short sentences, haiku-like and perfect, stood out as a great concise summary of a complex section. Man, these kids can write, I said to myself. It may be that I'm the only one who will listen when I talk like this. Man, I continued to myself, I can fucking teach. I immediately emailed the parents of that student to tell them how great their kid was at writing and reading, and to insinuate strongly that a very specific dude may well be the reason. Then, in the second student's work, does he want to die? The threats are real. Ah, I said aloud, alone at my desk after finding those formerly brilliant words, many of the longer and better summaries of many of my students word for word on various websites. The goddamn internet. Therein lies the dilemma with technology. The work can look better, be longer, more polished, more complete, and also still involve not a single moment of learning. I've taken to instituting a new policy in the work involved in my classes. A policy, or a rule, or, I suppose most accurately, a question. Can Google do this? I try not to assign anything the internet will do for the kids. The trick is to use the pervasiveness of technology and information as a plus. I can assume access to information, assume students can access dictionaries, spell checks, Spark Notes, Wikipedia, and move forward past the things those websites take care of. They know all that, or know where to find all that. So what next? What's further? This year, I applied the question to Othello, a text similar to Coffer Boy, in a few important ways. Students found the prose of each to be difficult to access while finding the subject matter to be pretty engaging. There was also a wide variety of previously written summaries, essays, and analyses of both spread liberally around the internet. Asking students to prove they read either would ultimately be a test of whether or not they could type the name close enough into a search engine for it to guess correctly. Othello. Did you mean Othello? We wrapped our study of Othello around issues of race and gender, most especially on how each is used to cast characters as other to their detriment. So gone are the days of chapter summary. Our first week assignment involved taking key terms from the sociological discussion. Dehumanization, misrepresentation, marginalization, normalization. Finding definitions online, synthesizing them into a definition in the students' own words, and including an example from the modern world, and two illustrative quotes from the first three scenes of the play, read in class. Will Google do all that? Not all of it, no. Will it help? If you use the internet, well, read closely and think. It will help. That's what I was looking for. The first assignment was a building block. I did not want to move forward with discussions where our key words were tossed around without the students mutually understanding them. The assignment is a little more worksheety than I like to get, a little easier to copy than I would hope, but I used class time to engage with the students in their work, answering their questions and to push their thinking. This strategy is called teaching. Lots of people do it. By the end of the week, I heard students remark that they were being dehumanized by the dress code and marginalized by the seating trends in the lunchroom, so I knew they were ready to move on. The next assignment asked students to pick any group that is marginalized. Students picked lots of different groups, women in video games and superhero comics, black women in reality TV, police officers, Muslims, victims of abuse, gun rights advocates, gay teens, and horror movie characters. Quite a few students latched onto the current discussion around native mascots in professional sports, because it's racist. The project reflected the diverse experiences and interests of the students, and I rarely had to say no or redirect an idea, which helped prove a point, that lots of humans treat other humans horribly. To prove their point, students used the internet to look at lots of different kinds of media that involved their group, to discover patterns and evidence, to read and analyze media as text and sociological artifact. The project had two goals. The first was to push the kids to disassemble and analyze things and discuss them intelligently. I told them it just wasn't powerful or interesting to say that the Washington Redskins' name is racist, but it was both powerful and interesting to be able to explain why. So they went and figured out a bunch of why. Plus, taking away phones and blocking websites does very little to curb internet bullying or any of the other ickies kids use the internet for. But teaching them empathy and literacy and basic don't be an asshole skills does a lot. The second goal was approached through a creative project after the analysis. Students created a counterstory to the things they found. This is where things got especially good. One student's idea was to rework the then logo of the University of North Dakota's Fighting Sioux to a Fighting Sioux logo of an angry-looking old lady. The student explained, "It's supposed to offend old white people. It's satire." So many magic words. A plus, young friend. Other students wrote treatments for shows that included characters of color with more depth and complexity. One student came in, I kid you not, with a poster board, presumably bought at Woolworth's or a Ben Franklin store in southeastern Wisconsin, with glue and paper, squiggly designs and all, that included facts and milestones of five people's lives. The words, "successful strippers," plastered across the top, blared with neon green and pink letters. In the meantime, we were still studying Othello, but almost none of that work went home with kids. The play, and what I wanted them to get from the play, did not pass the Google test. I felt confident that most of any reading I assigned to most kids would result in a SparkNotes free-for-all to complete whatever comprehension assignments that went with it. I don't love that it's true, but I'm realistic that it's true. Kids, my kids anyways, enough of them to be a relevant number, won't read at home when there is another option. So we did that work together, where I could control the pace, point out moments of great importance or relevance to our discussion, and the dirty jokes. I tried to make the funny parts funny and the villains infuriating. I did everything I could to make them, if not love Othello, at least understand why some people would. This is also called teaching. So those are some days at their best. Students using technology to find and reinforce knowledge, to study and discover how the world works while, and this was the trickiest part, applying the knowledge and enthusiasm generated to experience a classic work of genius at a deeper level than simply reading it and watching the movie. The last part is challenging because, really, most kids would rather not. Kids love looking at the world around them, at TV shows they love, and websites like Tumblr, which know them better than their parents. Getting students engaged in modern media is not a great challenge, but it's hard to avoid any media unit crawling so far up its own ass it doesn't know where it came from. Make a logo that represents a feeling inspired by a product worn by a celebrity. The Google test guides some pretty important things about my teaching. It helps me focus on teaching students skills they can apply broadly for my discipline, instead of wasting my and my students' time on details of stories and memory tests. The Google test asks, will this help the student 5 years from now? Does it teach them to use technology or to learn on technology? Above all else, it helps me know that they are thinking. Ah, but what about the tests? Bum, bum, bum. The mandated, soul-sucking, world-destroying tests. Shouldn't we be teaching to the tests so scores can go up? No. We should be teaching past the tests so scores can go up. My students, by being more engaged, by reading more deeply, by finding their own text to investigate, are ultimately working far harder on core reading skills than they would be if I handed them a packet, but they don't realize it. I'm tricky. In another project during the year, perhaps my very favorite project of the year, I teamed up with the world history teacher. Students picked a historic event from somewhere in the Middle East and learned a bunch about it. Many components of the project were similar to research projects and papers I have written and assigned in the past. There were a certain number of sources that had to be found, a general scope of the project to be adhered to, rubrics and checklists and due dates. It's the sort of stuff that every high schooler is doing in every high school, and also the sort of stuff that doesn't often pass the Google test. Our twist, and it proved to be an important twist, was in the final product. For a research project like this, students would normally write an essay with all their information, and you know what? A lot of them would do a pretty good job. The A's from the project would be solid A's, involving writing and rewriting, hours and hours and then some hours of hard work. A solid ratio of one mental breakdown for every 5 white girls in the room, and an essay that even the teacher wouldn't read every word of. The real problem is in the D's of the projects. The D's will be poor D's. Students will write things without really knowing. Students will cheat. You and I both know that they will. Many D's, in fact, will ride a fine line between plagiarism and summary, and many will jump the line with both feet and hope for the best. And who can blame them? As an English teacher, I started my career with a distressing reverence for the essay. It was, so far as I could tell, the height of all things in our craft, the catch-all assessment. Kids who could write good essays were good at English, and kids who couldn't weren't. I ignored the fact that I had skated through many literature classes learning nothing and reading less because I could write one hell of a bullshitting essay, and could write them long enough to be sure my teachers wouldn't read enough to know. After school ends, all but a small fraction of people will ever write an essay again. That's because essays aren't all that important anywhere but middle school, high school, or college. What's important, it turns out, are many, but not all, of the things that essays are good for. Essays show that you read something and thought about it, that you synthesized information, that you can make and support a good argument, that you can express your emotions and intents and beliefs to other people. They show all those things, which are important things. They also show how well you can use a certain dialect of English to write in very certain sorts of ways. So I assign essays sometimes when I want to test all those things. I don't assign them when I want to just focus on the first batch, the skills I think are the most important for my students moving forward. My students get lots of ways to show me they know English, even the ones who can't write for crap. For our research assignment, we did graphic novels. Students had to research and turn that information into something that could be drawn, a story that could be told. The key words were synthesize and humanize. Oh my God, some of them were awful. Stick figures, half drawn in pen and half in pencil. Misspellings galore. Stories that lacked most or any of the components of what a story should be. A few projects approached a sort of sick, brilliant, befuddling cross between a collage, a science project panel board, and a stream-of-consciousness acid-trip poem. Projects were the victims of wasted work hours and hurried completion. The beautiful wreckage of poorly applied pencil and potential. Those were the D's. The glorious D's. I was so proud of them. They were, without rival, the best group of D work I had ever received in my life. Why? Because there was nothing about those final products that could be Googled. Nothing that could be copy and pasted. Before you could draw a crummy picture, you had to at least have an idea of what that crummy picture should be of. It frustrated the hell out of some kids, kids who begged me to just let them do an essay. They didn't want to have to make something. So there were D's, furiously spectacular D's. But there were no F projects. F projects were impossible because the students had to do something, had to learn something in order to turn something in. The D's were good D's. There were also lots of A's. Lots of projects that showed a great amount of effort, thought, planning, and talent. They were better than essays because they were human. They were focused on people, on the experience of people, but were human especially because the personality of the students came through in what they wrote and drew. They read, researched, and thought, and those A projects took all that actual analysis and synthesis and made a whole brand new thing out of it. The A's were very good A's. But then there were the ultra A's. There were 2 or 3 assignments that were in the upper echelon of things I've ever had turned into me in all my years of teaching. There was one that was one of the best works of art I've ever seen. That project, a study of the wall that divides Israel and Palestine through the graffiti on each side, took 2 students just a shade over 3 months to finish. There were binders of research that went into making the 4-page story, cut down the middle by the wall, of a young Palestinian and young Israeli person sneaking to the wall at night to to create artwork that spoke of hope and beauty. It will be a portfolio piece for art school applications. It will hang on my wall for as long as I have a classroom. It turns out, and I should have known it, that kids will often do nothing if you let them. And kids will often make something brilliant if you give them the chance. This is perhaps the real goal of the Google test, to make more makers. We need students who are not just able to read, not just read and remember, and not just read, remember, and analyze. Those are all handy skills, but are all mostly passive skills. We need to make more makers. Students who don't just understand problems, but show they understand them by creating new and novel solutions. We need students who don't just read and remember, but who learn in order to do. The worst advice ever. In some schools, the sky falls down about once every 10 years. These are the schools where outside forces move slowly and new projects are introduced only when a committee about a committee has been approved to work toward the formation of a task force and everyone decides to move forward. In those schools, it will feel like the sky is falling, like life and school will never be the same, like any chance at success you may have been grasping at will be gone by next year, leaving behind only smoking wreckage and a post-apocalyptic landscape of students asked to write using only their own saliva and reading out of textbooks written only in corporate logo letters. These are the lucky schools, those that have years off from this feeling, and I do not work in a lucky school. In my school, the sky is perpetually falling down. The first time my school was supposed to end forever, there was some small amount of drama involving parent protests, letter writing, and speech giving. Things almost, but not quite, got to the level of button making. Buttons were threatened. A well-meaning teacher, one who had sort of appointed himself my mentor because he really liked hearing himself talk, I'm that guy now, pulled me aside one day. He put a hand on my shoulder and said, "When I was a young teacher, my department chair pulled me aside, just like this, and he gave me the best piece of advice I ever got." It was all very serious and dramatic. "Someday, young Simba, all that the sun touches will be yours." "Close the fucking door," he said. He said, "Close the fucking door." He went on from there, for quite some time, really, about all the reasons to ignore everything around you and just teach your class. Just close the door, do your thing, shut the rest out. It sounded a lot like really great advice. It was the absolute worst advice I've ever received. "Simba, screw everyone else. Go find a comfy bed and hang out. Simba, you can only worry about what you can change, and you can't change much. Friends, young friends, do not close your doors. Do not. It is not good for your school. It is not good for your room, for your kids, or for you. Open your doors. Go forth. Go forth and make messes and build things and throw your voice into problems in places where it is not asked. Go, go, go. Go, because teaching is a team sport. Because what you experience within your room should matter deeply to those outside of it. And what happens outside of school is hugely important to how things go in your room. Teaching can be too lonely, and it can be too easy to imagine you are the only one struggling or the only one getting it right. And neither of those things is ever true. Get out of your room. Talk to teachers about teaching. Talk to them about students. Look from as wide a lens as you can manage at the issues that shape school, and throw your energy and experience into making them better. Your building. It should go without saying that you should be involved in your building, but it turns out that it has to be said. I've worked with teachers who, halfway through the school year, couldn't tell me the names of anyone who worked in the office, where the computer lab was, or who ran it, or the names of any teachers who didn't share a lunch hour with them. Look, there's an absurd amount of work to do, most especially in your first or second year, but meeting the people you work with and building connections with them will help you get that work done better and more easily. Promise. There are lots of good ways to get involved in your building. Even if you are relatively introverted, it's pretty fascinating how many teachers are zany maniacs in front of a group of children but can't seem to get a word out of their mouths in a staff meeting. If you drink, go to happy hours. If you don't drink but can go to happy hours and order a soda and some fries, do that. Time outside of the room, outside of the building, away from the eyes of parents, students, and bosses is absolutely essential. Sure, happy hours can help you find new friends in your building, but it can also help smooth out relationships with people who you generally want to hit in the head with a desk. Teaching is important, and teaching feels important, and so it can feel really important during the day when someone takes the computer lab without signing it out correctly, or plans a hallway activity in front of your door without asking. On Wednesday, that person can feel like your enemy, or like an enemy to all that is good in the world, an enemy on the level of Sauron or Ultron or Man-Buns. Over a beer on Friday, it can seem kind of funny, and getting to know each other better will lessen the chances of violence on Monday, when they do the same damn thing again after you just told them not to. Please. If you're not the happy hour type, then quit. Get out. No one wants you here anyway, so you will fail, miserable and alone. Kidding. Jokes. If you're not the happy hour type, and loath though I am to admit it, there is some argument to be made that watching your coworkers get drunk enough to make any number of verbal, emotional, or physical humiliations may not directly serve the best interests of professional relationships. Don't make a lack of happy hours be the reason you don't get to know anyone. If there are meetings, go to meetings. Listen at first if you aren't confident in saying what you think. If work comes up during those meetings, get involved in that work. Supporting other people's ideas is a great way to get involved, build some allies, and, as a happy byproduct, probably get some work done that helps your school run better. Support, by the way, means doing a lot more than saying, "Hey, great idea!" Lots of people will say that, even when they think someone else's idea is shit. But teachers need support on a much deeper level than reassurance. Look around your school for the best things happening, and find out what help they need. When there are events, put your face there. When chaperones are asked for, put your body there. Throw some of your minutes at some problems, because minutes are the things that everyone ultimately needs more of. They will appreciate your minutes, and when you've got an idea that deserves some attention, you are far more likely to get it. Oh, and don't wait to have those ideas, and don't hesitate to speak boldly and bluntly when you feel like you should. Because here's the beautiful and awful and poetic thing about teaching. While teaching, you will have the exact job title in your first year as you do in your last. I like that. It means, it should mean anyway, that you have exactly as much right to speak and be involved in your first year as you do in your 20th. Just as experience should be listened to, so should the fresh perspective of a teacher early in their career. Anyone who makes you feel otherwise should be kicked in the shin with pointy shoes. Your union. It's possible you will work in a building that is not in a union. In that case, in my expert opinion, you will not be able to become involved in your school union. If you do work in a building with a union, join that union. That's the first step. Some places are better than others at finding you and helping you sign up. But be prepared to ask around until you find the sheet you need and get it filled out. Also, understand that filling out that sheet is not involvement. Wearing the right t-shirt on the right day is not involvement. At that point, all you've done is given your money away and looked like a nerd at the grocery store after work. It is not involvement. Your union is the primary voice of the teachers in your school and district. If your union is doing things you don't like or speaking in a voice that is not yours, you have two choices. You can choose to not be involved, which is, I suppose, a thing. Before you do that, you may want to ask yourself what good not being involved will do. You may feel justified in the midst of your own personal movie that no one is watching. You may feel as if you have taken a stand and cleared your conscience of your membership supporting something you don't like. Yep. But then what? The fuck the system teenager in me hates that I have come to this point. But I think it's often more powerful and productive to work from inside systems than it is to stand outside and throw stones. It took me a few years to get really involved in my local union. I went to meetings and kept my mouth shut, worried that the thoughts of a young teacher meant nothing in a room of experienced union hardasses. I heard enough of, "We've always done," and, "When you're here long enough, you'll know," to know somewhere deep down that I was expected to learn and not do. Not yet. A few years in, I was much more comfortable in my skin, and had begun to take on leadership roles in my school. But I still felt out of my depth when contracts and teacher rights were discussed. At the first big union meeting of the year, a month after we were supposed to have it, always, about halfway through the usual routine of eating through the president's report, a new teacher spoke up. "I came today to ask for help," he said, "because I don't know how else to get it." He was a first-year social studies teacher who continued by rattling off a long list of extra jobs outside of teaching he had been asked to do so far that year. There were dances, performances, a lock-in, additional meetings, setting up events, staffing events, cleaning up events. All that he felt he, as an untenured first-year teacher, which is a bit like being a turtle without a shell, could not say no to. He was exhausted and struggling to find the time and energy he needed to devote to actually teaching and learning to teach better. "I couldn't help notice," he said as he held his palms out, apologizing. that it's mostly new teachers doing all those things, and I think it would be really helpful if everyone pitched in so it didn't always fall on us. He was right. I'm sure it happens in many schools that teachers work like crazy during their first few years taking on extra responsibilities. I did. During my first few years, I acted as a coach, a chaperone, and an event planner. I worked constantly and nearly let stress drive me out of the classroom at least a dozen times. The vice president of our union answered him, quite matter-of-factly, "Just wait till you get tenure, and you can stop doing all the extra stuff." She was right. You kind of can. I mean, you can so long as you don't care about the people you work with. No one's going through due process to fire a teacher because they didn't come to the eighth grade dance or stay at the end of open house to fold tablecloths. I've done a little less, if I'm going to be honest, as I've gone through the years. I've stopped making sure I'm there for all of everything, have picked and chosen a little more, and let other people pick up my slack. It's an awful, awful thing we do, and we shouldn't. Presumably, as you work longer at being a teacher, you become better at teaching. The job becomes less stressful, and especially if you are teaching the same subject for many years in a row, the job becomes less work. People always blanch at being told they are doing less because it feels like you are doing a lot. But in my first few years, I had to create everything I used in my class. Every lesson plan, every assignment, every presentation. As the years went on, I would add and tinker all the time, but I had many, many things that I got to use again without thinking about for longer than 5 minutes. I had never spoken up at a union meeting until that moment, but that first-year teacher needed someone to tell him different. I asked if we, as a union and professional organization, could do more to push our teachers to help out. I asked if we could start a movement to help support our newer teachers in more ways. I was told, much as the other teacher was, that the first years just suck and everyone had to go through it. Someone actually used the phrase, sink or swim, and I threw a piece of bowling alley pizza at their face. I think that happened. It didn't. That year I ran for my first union position. In the years that followed, I was a constant nagging voice bringing things to the union that were different from what they had done, that were on my mind specifically because I had not been around for long enough. I don't say this to brag about my own awesomeness. My only special skill, if I have one, is the ability to keep talking even when everyone at a table is looking at me like I'm an idiot. Have I mentioned that I'm a white man? If you've gone to a few local meetings and just don't feel your time is being well spent, look for other levels of involvement. State organizations often feel and act much differently from local ones, and there are usually ways to get involved at a state level that the crankies in your local cannot stand in the way of. Look for trainings, town halls, or open meetings being held at your state union, and get involved. My state holds a summer program for a few days on a campus in the middle of nowhere. You get 3 days of a dorm bed and meals for $80, and you can go get drunk at night with everyone at the American Legion for $7. It was my first year at that summer program that led to my going to several national events. Oh, you want to pay to fly me to Vegas in January? Okay. Joining a committee to increase the engagement and strength of newer union members, and being convinced that change can come to and through our union. My involvement in my union, local, state, and national, has given me a chance to add my voice to the most powerful collective voice that teachers have. I've watched lots of things I don't like, and a few things I couldn't be more proud of, which is, I think, what real work looks like most of the time. Activism. This year a student was missing from my classroom. He wasn't sick, wasn't absent, but he wasn't there. The thing is, I really needed him in my room that day, and he wasn't there. The attendance program on my computer was showing nothing. None of his friends seemed to know where he went.
He was just behind me. Peeing? Maybe a girl talked to him. Yeah, right.
I got class started and called to the office.
Hey, I'm having trouble finding Josh.
Josh sometimes has trouble finding where he is supposed to be.
We've got him.
Sometimes he wanders to the office to chat with whoever's in trouble outside, because they often have the best stories. Oh, okay, is he on his way then? And sometimes they just need to remind him that, you know, class started 10 minutes ago.
He's being sent home. He'll be back Friday.
Oh, okay.
Oh, shit. Josh got suspended.
The voice from one of Josh's friends.
Texts travel faster than light.
A few minutes later, the attendance was updated, and there, right next to Josh's name,
suspension.
We got the whole story as the hour unfolded.
Josh was wearing a hat in the hallway and was told by a staff member to take the hat off.
Why?
It's a good question when you think about it.
Because it's a school rule.
Not a good answer.
That's dumb.
It is.
Take it off, now, or I'm taking it from you.
Also dumb.
Fucking bullshit.
Not strategically great, though a poetically compelling statement. Both people involved in the conversation had voices raised by the end. The staff member was, I'm sure, just trying not to spend a long time enforcing a rule, and was upset at anything but immediate compliance.
Josh can get loud and mad, especially when someone is coming at him in a way he sees as rude.
Nothing says rude like demanding immediate compliance. Josh was sent to the office, already heated. When he walked into the admin's office, she continued right where the staff member left off.
Sit down. Now.
She stands up.
No.
He stands still.
I don't like your attitude.
She steps forward.
That's because this is fucking bullshit.
He stands still.
Language.
She points her finger.
Fuck this.
He walks out. He gets suspended. I'm on Josh's side here, not just because I needed Josh in class. From his perspective, he was just walking down the hallway and he got hassled about a dumb hat, no doubt with four other kids wearing hats within sight. Then, for no real good reason, swearing is a lot less a big deal to some people, and Josh is one of those people. Josh is sent to the office, where he is treated like he just punched a puppy. And then he is sent home for 3 days for calling bullshit on some bullshit. Nothing, it should be noted, or hardly ever anything, is ever said to the adults along the way who escalated the student to the point of his snapping. From their point of view, the action of the staff members involved are simple to understand. If we let kids get away with hats, there would be no order. If we let kids get away with swearing, there would be chaos. If we let kids call bullshit, there will be riots. Riots! Or maybe just people get tired and they find it's a lot easier to say that kids come first than it is to really treat them like they do. If Josh were the first or the only, I likely would have been content to write a vague, snarky Facebook post about the incident and move on with my life. Josh wasn't the first, not even a little bit. I had noticed the pattern in my room of students being sent home for things like disrespect and insubordination. Sometimes loudness was being read as threatening, and sometimes quietness was being treated as an admission of guilt. Suspensions were conditioning my students to see themselves as bad kids. They were not reforming behavior. They were undercutting a community of building respect based on relationships, and supplanting them with a community of acting like you respect people or else. Plus, Josh wasn't in my class, and I really needed him in class that day. Every day he's not in class is a day I can do very little for him. I need my kids in class. Even, in fact, especially those students who are having trouble staying in school. I want the kids in my room, and I want them all there. The kids getting sent home are disproportionately black and brown kids, and they're getting sent home for not fitting into a white and white system. I want them in my room so they can show me where that system needs pushing and call me on my shit. And because it's absolutely criminally stupid that we haven't figured out yet how to serve them better. I want the kids in my room because it's their right to be there. Schools aren't built for me to have a nice day. They are built to create opportunities for kids, to discover and expand talent, to give tools for all the work our students may someday do. These are the things we can't do without kids in the room. I want the kids in my room now, and if we're sending them home for being disrespectful, we should be ashamed of ourselves for not earning their respect. If a student is having a problem, and the problem only escalates as we intervene, we should not be suspending that student. We should be taking a hard look at our interventions. Sending them home is the easy way out for the day, but builds nothing for their return. Josh was the catalyst that got me reading about suspensions and finding that I was actually pretty late to the party. There were a few hard-working groups in my area already publicly pushing for an end to nonviolent suspensions. I liked those groups on Facebook, and I felt pretty good about myself. The next week, another kid got suspended, and I started reading every article those groups posted on Facebook, even taking the step of liking each one of those statuses, so, you know, it was getting pretty badass. In a conversation with a teacher at another school, I brought up suspensions, and she told even more striking tales of tomfoolery and shitheadery at her school. That day, a leader from one of the regional groups sent out an invite for a group. I went. I raised my hand. I committed to action, and I took my first steps toward working as an advocate for my students and colleagues outside of my own school building. Suspensions may not be your thing, but whatever your thing is,
I can almost assure you that there is a group working on it somewhere. Look for groups that are working on what you care about, because those groups are looking for you. If there isn't one, you can start one, and you should. You should because just like it's crucial to your students what the teacher in the room next to you is doing, it is important to your school what the schools around you are doing. So it's important to get involved outside of your school. Advocacy is also supremely energizing. Many teachers have shied away from the step outside of their school because it feels like one more thing. We work hard. Of course we do. It's hard to imagine putting in hours doing anything more than we are doing. I get that. But we are used to the one more things that come from our schools, and those things are often tiring for the exact same reasons the rest of our day is tiring, and we are often at our limit for that specific brand of tiring. Those arguing against engaging at a broader level are missing out on a very important thing. When you do work outside of your school, no one knows your assistant principal. I've been hard on admin so far in this section, which is not my general approach to my bosses, but hear me out on this point. Even when your administrators are good, teachers often spend their time with each other bitching about them. Why? Because no one likes being told what to do, and no one likes being told they can't have everything they want. And who in the building is often most responsible for delivering those messages? Well, your principal is often busy that day, so your assistant principal will likely be the one sending the "stop by my office" email. When we are with teachers from our own buildings, even or especially at union meetings, we often talk about small problems. Those small problems can be really important, but no one gets into teaching to fight for a 5-minute longer lunch break. No one believes the purpose of education is to minimize the travel time and noise of students between rooms. And when you work with teachers or advocates away from your building, you will quickly find that no one cares how those things are going in your building. Big groups deal with big problems, and being a part of them can keep you centered on the real reasons you wanted a classroom in the first place. They can be something that actually takes some one more things off your plate because they help you see that a whole lot of them aren't that important to you. They can also help challenge another popular saying among teachers, that you should only worry about what you can change. Teachers, and probably normal people too, use the phrase, "you can only worry about what you can change," as an excuse to not work on plenty of very changeable things. What they mean, whether they understand they mean it or not, is, "I don't want to worry about things I don't feel like putting the work in to change." But who wants to be that person, really? We can't do it all, and certainly not by ourselves. The great thing is, we don't need to. I know this one guy who is an absolute ed nerd. He loves policy and meetings and everything else awful in the world. We both agree that we're at A and need to move to Z. His work is all about moving A to B to C, while my work is often about stomping my feet and yelling that we need to be at Z 3 decades ago. I like to think of him as an education professional and myself as an education activist. I often think of myself as having cooler descriptions than the people around me, but he's also a foot and a half taller than I and blisteringly attractive, so he can handle it. The thing is, I need him. We're never getting to Z without some persistent, progressive change in that direction. The other thing is, he needs me. We're never moving past C if there's not yelling and stomping about how much further we have to go. We each do our work. We each work where we are most comfortable and effective. When things are working best, we are doing our work together. The really important things, the really big important things, the things that make teaching the hardest and best job in the world, are things that teachers can change. We can't change them by tomorrow, and can't change them alone. And can't change them without a whole lot of work and stress and loudness. But we can change them if we show up to try. White guy bullshit. Bitch. This was the intro to the term dehumanization for my 10th graders, who would spend much of the rest of world literature talking about the ways writing and words are used to dehumanize people and groups of people, and how they can also be used to humanize. We were reading a short story by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie about two women, a Christian and a Muslim, trapped in a room during a religious riot. Dehumanization is the kind of concept that takes months to really land with students. This story is the kind of story that gets referred back to for months. I wanted kids to start to kick around the idea of having humanity, of what it means to be recognized as fully human, and then the way that that humanity can be minimized, dismissed, or removed. It is many big thoughts. After giving a very simple definition of dehumanization, I open the floor for examples.
The Holocaust.
Yep, that's always the first example. It gives me a chance to say my thing, which is, no human has ever purposely hurt another human. What I mean is that in order for any of the small or large harms in human history to have occurred, someone had to be viewed as less than human. Again, though, that's something I throw out there over and over because I think it's the smartest thing I say. Then there's a pause.
Bitch.
Bitch is almost always the second example that students come up with when we talk about dehumanization. Their why is almost always the same, too.
Because it means female dog.
See? Because dogs aren't human. I often let kids kick and claw their way through bitch for a while, and they often come to some really interesting definitions of the word. They figure out that when someone is called a bitch, it really has nothing to do with dogs. One group one year came up with an unideal woman, which is interesting. And another expanded that to an unideal person of your gender, which is kick a chair insightful. This year, a student said, a woman who isn't acting like a man wants her to. Bam! Kids are smart. Plus, now we're talking about dehumanization as something a lot more complex than calling someone an animal. But those are the ends of long conversations. Conversations that are given time and space and are conducted in a place that is safe for those participating. On the day I'm thinking of, the day just after the Adichie story, the conversation took one of the sharp turns that conversations can take. The, I don't think people should be offended by that discussion. That discussion, often introduced and pushed by a person sitting in privilege, and today offered by a student whose name was something like Jiggy or Boff or something you would name the sidekick friend in an 80s movie, is an often necessary piece in unearthing the difference between speaking to people and speaking for people. But on the day that I'm thinking of, I didn't feel like I had that kind of time. We were a day away from an extended break, and I had a very specific goal for the lesson, so instead of doing something smart, I did something dumb. When this student, Jiggy or Rudy or whatever, carefree and sure of his world-dominating brilliance in a way that males often seem to be, cough, me, cough, began to speak for the women in the room, he explained to them that they shouldn't be offended by the word bitch because whatever reasons. Another student, Liz, fierce and well-armed in a way that females seem to have to be, and never seem to be in movies that dudes like Rudy are in, let him have it, calling him out on his privilege, on the misogyny implicit in a man telling women what they should think and why. I said, you both have good points, and both should listen to each other. And I totally get how it seems like the intent of what you say should matter and be important. And there are totally situations where bitch is used where it is acceptable. And a really nuanced conversation about this would allow for our ability to see things differently. And really, all this needs to be later, and we'll get there, I promise. But we can't get there now. But sometime, for sure, we'll get there. So, essentially, I said, wordsy words, words. Boys get to say what they want. Angry girls get shut down. I'm important. Blah, blah, blah. Look at my stupid sport coat. You know how the last thing you can say to an angry person that is helpful is, you should calm down? That's pretty much what I did, and it was a dumb thing. When the class discussion broke up, I went over to Liz, a student I had known for 4 years, a student whom I had supported in a thousand ways, a student who, when I walked over, said, get away from me. Really? It's like that? Really, it is. So now I was pissed, and Liz was very opposite of calm. My student added a healthy dose of betrayal to her feelings of anger because I was not supposed to be that teacher. I always said I wasn't that teacher. I was rewarded constantly as not that teacher, and I was being that teacher and silencing her justifiable anger in favor of the comfort of the kid who just said a bunch of offensive shit. I know all this because we both calmed down enough to go talk in the hallway, and she said, you're supposed to be the teacher who doesn't do that, and you did that. You were silencing my justifiable anger in favor of the comfort of the kid who just said a bunch of offensive shit. She was super right, and I was being an asshole. I let her know by saying, you're super right, and I'm being an asshole. Sometimes I swear at school, and nothing bursts into flames. It turned out that Liz had seen a lot of things along the way, things I had screwed up, things that had centered male voices in the room and allowed some pretty awful things to be said in the name of honoring perspectives. She had let a lot of them slide, or rather, swallowed them and let me keep thinking I was being super great when I was really perpetuating a lot of the stuff in the exact moments I thought I was working against it. I was the best bet she had during her day, and she had been burned by people who reacted poorly at getting called on their shit. She let it all out then, there in the hallway. She cut me off at the knees and told me that I thought I had this radically social justice classroom, and really, I just used the words a lot. Then she said, "Okay, thanks for listening to that." And then she left. I spent the long weekend reflecting on all of that. I was sure I had messed up, but I wasn't sure exactly how to do things better. Funny thing was that during that long break, I was on my way to a conference on racial equity, and, in a way that is not common in my life, found myself for days and days sitting and thinking hard about being not just a guy, but a white guy, and realizing that no matter how hard I tried, I would always be a white guy standing in front of the classroom. And it was past time I understood exactly what that meant. So it was that 4 days later I was sitting with a group of white men. As a white male, sitting in a group of white men is not an abnormal experience for me. Really, it's something I do just about every day. What was different about this group was that we were sitting together specifically because we were white men, because we were white men at a racial equity conference in a session about the intersections of race and gender, and because we were told to sit with people who identified as our same race and gender, because there are few things as uncomfortable for white people than pointing out the whiteness of a whole bunch of white people. So I was in this group, this white male group, and we were assigned the task of describing what it means to be white and male. It was a challenge. We wrote the words we knew we were supposed to write, since we had all been in enough conversations about race to know the right answers. We wrote empowered and intelligent and fixers and holders of knowledge. Tucked-in polo shirt guy said, "I don't like that everything on this list is negative." So let that sink in a little bit. So reflexive was our guilt that our list of words was viewed as negative rather than as privilege. Shit. We kept going, but the group began to bristle at every new addition. And before long, the frustration spilled over enough to effectively derail the exercise. "I don't identify with that word," we started to hear. And as the "not me" and the "that's not universal experience" and the "I don't think all of us" comments began to bump out the conversation, it started to sound all too familiar. "Not all men," we were saying. "Not all white men." We were, as the most dominantly represented group in the country, unwilling to accept the idea that we were in fact a group. Teachers, of course, do this, especially white teachers. We struggle to understand that we are not just a white teacher in the front of the room, but another white teacher in the front of the room. One day I had a student, Mo, who was late to class for what felt like the begillionth day in a row. After a warning, I demanded we make a call home together so his mom knew what was up, and he blew the fuck up. There was some yelling from both, a healthy smattering of swear words, not for me, I don't swear when I'm angry. And suddenly we were 10 or so minutes into class without a single bit of teaching, and a student who was obviously physically upset. To recap, in order to try to start class and learning on time, I tried something that resulted in all students starting class much, much later, and directly and negatively affected the learning of the student I was addressing. I'm not always very good at this. When things calmed, I sat near Mo in a space away from other kids. Both of us were still pretty heated and trying hard to make the other person hear us without trying very hard to hear each other. He said, "Man, I just think sometimes that all white teachers are racist, and all I have is white teachers." So I stopped my rant and heard that. White teachers. I know a few things for sure, and when conversations about race are happening, specifically when one of your students of color is talking to you about their experience, it is your job to stop teaching and listen. Don't rationalize. Don't defend. Just shut up a minute and hear what they are telling you. So I listened. I heard that this student has 7 classes a day, and all are taught by white people. I heard that this was the 2nd year in a row that this was true. "It's just too many white people," I heard. I heard that the person in the building this student was most comfortable talking to was a substitute teacher, a black male, who was here once or twice a week. "I tell him everything," I heard. I heard this student feels constantly singled out, treated unfairly, is called out when white kids are doing the same things, and that it's always been like this. Year after year, class after class, it's been like this. So it is no wonder that in my and most classes, that when there is time to work and time to choose where to sit, my black students sit together. It is often treated as a negative. Why are all the black kids sitting together? There are assumptions about the dangerousness or volatility of black students occupying the same space. Walk through a school and look into classes with seating charts. Notice especially where black males are seated in relation to each other. Watch the assumption when a group of black students working are assumed to be wasting time, especially when their focus and engagement may be reflected in louder ways than a group of white students working or quietly disengaged. These are things I enforce when I am not thinking. Surrounded by whiteness in rooms very often led by white people, my students create black space during work time. My job is to let them. If that doesn't make sense, think of it this way. As teachers, we are surrounded all day by students. That's okay. It's not like we hate students, but it can be a bit exhausting to be around them all day, to change the way we speak and our mannerisms to be able to communicate more effectively with them. So when it is time for supervision at the end of the day, and there are tons of kids running around, teachers will often congregate together. They create teacher space, where they can talk about being a teacher and can speak and act freely, where they can just fucking breathe for a second. There are signs that the students are not fully comfortable with the space and culture of my room. I own that. I work on that. I can also give them room, make sure that I am not parking myself by the black kids to redirect any talk or off-task moments, while the white kids in the room are on Tumblr or drawing Doctor Who fan art free from harassment. I can understand and encourage the academic, emotional, and social support our kids of color are giving each other, instead of wringing my hands about that group over there and all the work I assume they aren't doing. I can build room and reason and direction for black and brown spaces in my room and in my practice. The interactions with Liz and Mo are not isolated. The interactions in our classrooms never are. I am not just a teacher. I am a white teacher, and my interactions are weighted with the interactions of other white teachers my students have had. Of all the privileges of being white and being male, the most powerful and seductive is that we are, each of us, a complete and human and individual person whose actions and beliefs operate independently of any other person on the planet. We are, each of us in our own ways, unwilling to commit to what it means to be part of the group we are sitting in, unwilling to accept the responsibility and reality of being a member of that group. I've been watching in conversations around me and online as white people, especially white males, are denying the perspectives of people of color, are speaking over and through the voices of women, of anyone suggesting that either white or male is a group, to say, "It offends me that you don't see each of us as individuals," as if the narratives told about people of color and women don't constantly treat them as a homogeneous identity. I watch as white people, especially white males, say that talking about race is what perpetuates racism. I watch as males, especially white males, threaten rape and murder to women who have spoken out about sexism, or spoken out at all, about just about anything. I've been thinking about how badly I don't want to be one of those guys, but how it's also really important for me to understand that, like it or not, the privilege those guys are so aggressively protecting is the same privilege I benefit from. It matters that I'm a white guy, and the reality of what that means matters every damn moment that I'm a white guy in a classroom. I've been trying to figure out what the real answers should have been at the conference. When that group conversation started, a participant raised their hand and said, "How are we supposed to talk about race and gender when we're all white men?" So, let that sink in too. Let that sink in and think about how often panels on race and gender issues about non-white, non-male issues are being spoken to by white men. We are experts, apparently, on everything but what it means to be white and male. I say we intentionally. I mean me. I mean all white people. If we are talking about those things, we need to talk about them more. We need to take responsibility for the fact that very few white people truly engage in the conversation. Very rarely talk about race in spaces that are all white. We need to talk about race in groups of white people where it is uncomfortable to talk about them. We need to talk about them in staff meetings, not just equity trainings. I'm saying we because it's uncomfortable for me to do. I so badly want to say, most, but not me, not all of us. But that's the problem, isn't it? White male privilege is not polite, is not sterile. It is a dangerous, messy, frighteningly powerful piece of my experience, of my daily teaching experience. Don't think this doesn't happen in classrooms. From my desk one day, I had a front row seat to the damage that a well-meaning white guy can have while really thinking he's doing the right thing. This time it wasn't me, which is why it was so much easier to see than all the screwing up I'd been doing. A government class of seniors was in the hallway having a sort of circle conversation. Circles can be powerful and positive, a place where every voice is equal and equally included. This circle involved each student speaking until they said something that hit the play button on any number of the thousands of pre-programmed mini-lectures the teacher had at the ready. The students were talking about efforts that could be taken to improve police-community relations, and I could see where the teacher